from somewhere in the Houston Midtown area. It's The Sit Down with Slick Vic.
Welcome, everyone. It's The Sit Down with me, Slick Vic. Today I'm joined by an old friend, former coworker, the very unique Adam Despain. Adam, it's been a while. Actually, it hasn't been a while since we've seen each other. We saw each other the other day.
First time in a while.
Yeah. We had a little talk about what had just happened to you. You were training at a very fine establishment here in the city of Houston. And, if you'd like to take over.
So, there are, in the city of Houston, let's say something like 4, 5, 6 restaurants. It could be debated, is the number one restaurant in town.
I think so. Definitely the best. Yeah, I agree.
The one I was training at, you could argue, is the best one in town. But even if you want to argue it's not, it's in the top 4, 5, or 6. And, you know, this isn't cool enough to brag about or anything. Certainly not bragging here. But one weakness of mine that's always been there is that I start off slow. For a great example, my mother used to tell me that she thought she would have to hold me back from preschool because I wasn't walking yet. And that's really odd for a kid that's 3, 3.5, approaching 4 years old. And she said, it took me forever to learn how to crawl. And then when I learned how to crawl, I was a bullet. I crawled everywhere. There was nowhere you could prevent me from going. And then it took me forever for me to learn how to walk. And my mother said that I walked for like half a day and then I was running. I'm not the quickest learner, but when I get something, I end up being really good at it for most things that I do consistently. Obviously, if I'm going to, you know, try skiing out tomorrow for the first time, it's not going to be like that. But I'm a slow starter, and I studied all my tests. I didn't get below a 97 on any of my tests. And these are some brutal, brutal, brutal tests, like learning every single ingredient and every single sauce in the entire restaurant. I actually have my note cards over here if you really want to see them. I don't know why I haven't thrown them away yet. And then toward the end, it was just really hard for me to put together in time. I have no doubt that I would have been a success in that restaurant if I'd had just a little more time. But I have nothing bad to say about them. They gave me as much time or even a little bit more than a lot of people. They treated me fairly. I don't have a negative word to say about them. But I will say that it was really difficult for me when I started taking tables over initially, because you have to repeat certain things absolutely verbatim, which fly in the face of what I've been doing for 10 or 15 or plus more years. Like completely different verbiage that I just had a really tough time with in the moment, especially seeing as you had to write everything down with their abbreviations. And when you're taking an order from someone, trying to remember certain abbreviations, trying to word things exactly the way they want them being worded. And it's all in a moment with a guest that doesn't know that you're in training, you're trying to keep it natural. It was, honestly, I had a really tough time with this. And I wasn't able to put it together quite fast enough. But I was literally just a cunt hair away from getting out of that training. And I think I could make the case of a little bit of bad luck here and there. I can make the case of this and that. But at the end of the day, no one there treated me unfairly. I didn't get it done.
It sounds to me like this establishment wants more of a, like an actor, right, with the script. They want to give you the script as opposed to being more of a, what I've always loved about being, because I served, and I loved the, it's kind of like an improv, right? Each guest, you didn't have to say it the same way. You really could gauge the person, kind of put your little touch on it. You know, not everybody wants that, the same person, right? And they kind of want it, no, you need to say it like this. They want it like this. So
I can't fault you for feeling like for that being the impression that you have, because that's certainly the impression that it gives off. But that's actually not true.
Okay.
They want you to learn some things. Like for example, there's a spiel. That there's like 2.5 pages long of a spiel you have to memorize word for word. Mm. But it's really more like 3, 3.5 pages long, because there's stuff you keep having to add in.
Right.
Like market prices for this and this and that kind of stuff. They want you to learn that spiel word for word, knowing that most of the time you'll never say that spiel word for word. And it was one of the difficult things with me and my fellow trainees in class in the beginning part of the training process. because they're like, because all the trainers would be like, yeah, you have to know this word for word. But when you do it in the mock and when you do it for guests, it doesn't have to be word for word, but you have to know it perfect. But you don't have to do it perfect. And we would constantly be like, what the fuck are you talking about? That makes no sense. And at the end of it, it made sense. It's because they wanted you to know their material, their spiel so well that you could be interrupted 1,000 times. And even if you don't get the whole spiel out, you'll hit the major points and not falter for a second. Most restaurants are totally cool, understanding. They expect you for a month or two or whatever out after you get out of training. You might be a little uncomfortable until you put everything together. This place, day one on the floor, everything's got to be put together perfectly or you're not going to pass. And that's the difference. There's no question in my mind I would have been absolutely fantastic at this restaurant. But I wasn't allowed that extra time after training to continue putting everything together the way I want to. It had to be put together by the end of training, or you don't pass the mock, you don't get on the floor, and you don't make the big bucks that everyone else makes. That was the difference. But I wouldn't say that you have to be like a scripted guy there. Not by any means. They have too many return guests and not as many first time guests. So return guests don't want to hear the bullshit. So they understand it, and they were actually pretty cool with it, but you had to know it so well that you didn't have to think about it.
Now, a little bit about yourself before we got into talking about your current situation. Let's go back in time. Let's talk about, first of all, I can't recall, where are you originally from? Are you from California or?
That's funny. You can't recall because I never talk about it because I'm not from anywhere. I have nothing to hide. My favorite answer to that is that I am a child of the world. And yes, I'm an American and I'm a veteran and I love the United States as much as anyone else, but I consider myself just a citizen of the world. My father is retired Air Force. His father before him was retired Air Force. My mother's father is retired Marine. We have military through both branches of my family, both sides, through and through. I'm the middle of 3 boys, the only one of which served myself. I was born in Guam, and as the joke goes, I like to tell my guests, I was born in Guam because my father was in the Air Force, then we moved around a whole lot, and then to piss him off, I joined the Navy, then I moved around a whole lot. that's the joke I've been saying for years. It works. I got a cheap laugh out of you. Thank you. People ask me, where are you from? I'll be like, I'm not really from anywhere. They'll be like, well, where are you born? I'll be like, well, I was born in Guam. And they're like, where the fuck is Guam? And I'm like, who gives a shit? I moved when I was 6 months old. So, like, I can't say I'm from there.
Well, let me ask you this. The reason why I go to California, right, because you and I are both one of the smartest people when it comes to football. Because we both...
I definitely am. Absolutely.
We're just both kidding. Ride or die 49er fans.
Absolutely.
Of course, that's on the coast. And, I put one on top of the other. But, you know, did you... You lived there for a little while, I'm assuming?
I've never lived in San Francisco.
Okay. No, California.
Or the Bay Area.
Okay.
My mother's side of the family is from Long Island, New York, and they moved to California right before my mother's senior year in high school. And if you get her in the right mood, she'll still bitch about that to this day, and she's approaching 70. That was like a mini early midlife crisis for her. And if you've moved in the middle of a high school year, when you go from Miss Popular to Miss Nobody Knows or Gives a Shit About You, it's a very traumatic experience. And as a military brat that moved around a bit, I can understand that quite a bit. So I'm not making fun of my mom. Totally would, but not in this case. But my father's side of the family is from California. A lot of it from the Bay Area-ish. And my mom's mom, who was from Long Island, ended up settling down in the Bay Area for many, many years. And she would visit us, because we're a military family, we're away from all our relatives. She'd visit us once a year. And since I was the only son of the three of us that was interested in football, she would bring over 49er stuff every year. And I don't remember it this way exactly, but my mother has told me on repeated occasions, Adam, you were groomed to be a 49ers fan from your grandma. And the really depressing thing about it is that when my grandma died, which, by the way, she died the best way anyone could possibly imagine dying. She was 91 years old and died in her sleep peacefully. Who the fuck gets that? A 49ers fan gets that. Okay, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But yeah, no, after she passed, I asked my mom. My mom was like, is there anything at first that you want? And I was like, what would an old white grandma have that I would want? I can't think of a single thing. Would she have some fucking abacus or something? Like, you know, what the hell would I? And I was like, I don't know anything 49ers. And mom goes, Adam, she gave you everything 49ers that she had. Like, I might be able to find a pair of earrings somewhere, but like, Adam, she died poor and she gave you everything that she had because you were the one 49ers fan that was in the family. And that hit me so hard. But no, so I have a lot of family from the Bay Area on my father's side. My mother's side, you had family that settled down in the Bay Area after they were adults. And being a military kid, moving around all over the place, I fell in love with the 49ers. The Joe Montana going up against the Bengals, pointing out John Candy in the stands when I was in the third grade. And it just so happened that my grandmother was and my family was from California, and it just clicked, and it just never changed after that.
So I know that you, when you were young, you started playing the piano.
Yeah.
How old were you when you started playing the piano?
I have to guess. Maybe 6, maybe 7, something like that.
Was that something that you wanted to do? Was it more one of your parents?
That's a funny story. That's a story I really haven't told because it just sounds so stupid. The only other time it would come up would be in like a bar, but like no one would listen anyway. I'll keep this as brief as possible because it sounds very self-ingratiating, but this is the truth. I had a neighbor four doors down. His first name was Andy. I remember his full name, although I haven't spoke to him since we're that young. And he was taking piano lessons. And him and I, this is in Great Falls, Montana. Him and I would literally play kickball and fly kites together, like super white boy shit in Great Falls, Montana. That type of shit, okay? No bones about it. And there was only one mall in Great Falls, and the only thing I remember about it, because I was so young, is we always went in through the JCPenney entrance, and there was the Orange Julius stand right there. And I remember there was one day that we went there on a Saturday, specifically because he was having a piano recital with his studio in the mall. And they have cords or ribbons or curtains, whatever you want to call those red ropes up, to keep people out. And there's a line of young kids, all beginner young kids, all, you know, let's say between the ages of like 6 and 12 or something like that, lined up to play like their one piece and move on. Just a quick kind of recital thing. I don't remember much of this, but as the story goes, there was a student that was playing, and I was so short and young, I literally just didn't even have to duck underneath the red marker, like you see in a cinema or whatever, and creeped all the way up to this kid playing. I'll still remember the name of this piece to the day I die. It's called Shanta Rob. Nothing impressive, a beginner piece. And apparently by the end of the piece, I'm standing there just staring at him afterwards. And after that, which is like grossly awful etiquette, by the way, you never do that to anybody. That's like the worst thing, the most rude thing you could do to any performer. But apparently, as the story is told to me, after that, every single parent went up to my parents and was like, if he's not in piano lessons, why? Why is he not in piano lessons? You should get a piano and get him in piano lessons right now. And after that, I got in piano lessons.
So it called to you.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I'm no Mozart, but there's actually a story of Mozart doing the same thing as he... Here's I believe it was like a piano concerto or opera. I remember what it was. But when he was younger, he floated down the stage, like this in a theater, right? And he's walking down the aisle, just transfixed. Now, I'm no Mozart. I'm not a prodigy or anything like that. I was good when I had my moment, but I'm not comparing myself to Mozart. But apparently there's a similar story with Mozart involved as well. Yeah. Some people, the music just grabs them, and I guess I was one of them.
Yeah, I have a very strong love for music, man. I tried the guitar out at one point, but it was one of those things where I gave it a couple months and I just kind of stopped doing it.
It's easier as a kid, not only because kids pick up things quicker, but also because when you're a kid, you have a parent going, you will practice for the next half hour. when you're an adult, I don't know when this was when you tried to pick up the guitar, but when you're an adult, it is so much more difficult to self-motivate yourself.
No, I was like 16, 17.
Same thing then. You don't have a parent over you going, you better do this. You have teachers on the line depending on you. You have your recital. You have this upcoming tournament coming on. You better do this or you're screwing everything up. No, when I was growing up, it was like that. It was the different side of the music industry where it was like, no. Your instructor's reputation is depending. You're her best student. So if you don't go out there and kill it, you're going to maybe not destroy your reputation, but definitely fuck it up. So it was a little different for me.
Can you recall the first recital you ever did? Or maybe... Because do you do recitals by yourself? Or were you with lots of kids performing? How did that usually go down?
I don't know if I can remember my first recital. But I will tell you that I did a year in Great Falls under a teacher that may have been great. I don't know. I don't remember her name. It was my first year and no student's going to do much in their first year. I don't care who you are. Unless you're a Mozart or something. Then I went to Nebraska and studied under Jerry Niver. Google her up to this day. She's a huge, huge deal. I was a part of her program a little earlier on. She taught lessons in a piano gallery. They sold pianos in a private room in the back. And so when it came to piano recitals, you would literally have, I don't know who did it, but someone, not me, someone would go in there and all these pianos that are on wheels, push to the side, have one or two pianos set up in front with fold-out chairs for the audience. And the audience consists of other students and their parents and their bored-ass brothers and sisters that have to be dragged along because their parents don't want to pay for babysitters for an hour and a half or something, right? So those are the people you're playing for. I can't remember the exact first one I played in, but I do remember it was most likely in that piano hall. I don't remember what I played. But I do remember that Jerry Niver had two students that were above the rest. Not trying to brag or sound cool here. There was this girl by the name of Jessica who was 2 or 3 years older than me who was phenomenal. She was phenomenal. And then it was me. And we were her two top students at the time. This was like over 20 years ago. 25 years ago. This was a long time ago. I'm 41 years old. But yeah, so it always seemed to be not a competition between us because she was older, had more years of lessons, that kind of stuff. She was clearly going to be better than me. But at the same time, I remember hearing her play and me going, okay, I got this bitch. Give me another year or two. I got this bitch. And I won't say I ever got her, but unless you're interested, I won't go into it. But there's actually a story where she fucked up on stage in Jocelyn Museum in Omaha, Nebraska, the point where she ran off stage crying, which is like unheard of. And I went up after her and like salvaged my teacher's reputation, basically.
Nice, you crushed it.
I crushed it, yeah.
Nice.
But I didn't know that she ran off stage. I didn't know anything, but no one told me this. My teacher, Jerry, actually tried to talk me out of playing because, hey, if one student fucks up, not a big deal. If I go up there and fuck up, that's her two best students fucking up. And that would be a really bad deal for her. But neither her nor my parents wanted to tell me that she fucked up this bad because the recital was set up in two phases. She was playing in the morning. I was playing in the afternoon. So I wasn't even around there for it. I didn't hear anything about it. So my parents and Jerry Niver, neither one of us wanted to tell me because if I did play, they didn't want to add the pressure to me. But at the same time, they tried to talk me out of playing. And the whole time I'm going, I've been working on this shit for months. I'm ready to go. You know, I'm as arrogant as any, you know, I don't know how old I was, 10, 11 year old kid I was. And I did go up there and nail it, and apparently that helped out Jerry Niver quite a bit.
So you saved her reputation.
I wouldn't go that far, but certainly I didn't fuck it up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I don't want to give myself more props than I deserve, of course. So.
So I do recall you telling me before that you got a scholarship for your piano.
So I quit playing the piano. Cause I got burned out. I felt like I was a performing monkey. And I remember I wanted to quit anyway, but I had a hard time telling my parents I wanted to quit because I was just too fucking burned out. I just stopped giving a shit. Every month, every other month, we're just gearing up for some huge event. And all this pressure was on me all the time. And I was just like, man, I'm not having fun with this anymore. This is a fucking job. And I'm 11 years old, 12 years old. And so I used my father's retirement from the Air Force as an excuse. Because when he retired from the Air Force, he couldn't find a suitable job in Omaha, Nebraska. found a job in San Antonio where we moved, and I didn't play for like 2 or 3 years. And it was like the last time my parents told me, hey, Adam, we're going to sell that piano because it's just sitting there and you're not playing it. You either go for it or we're selling it. And we've said this to you before, but this time, like, we've already put out ads online. Like we're going to sell this shit. And I was like, okay, I want to give it another go. So my parents found, I don't know how they did this before the age of the internet, but they found among the most prolific private instructors in the state of Texas. Her name is, I don't know if she's still alive, but her name is or was Marsha Buffler. And, ooh, maybe I shouldn't be saying names. Okay, her name is Marsha. I don't know. Maybe you can edit that out. But anyway, I don't have anything negative to say. But all I'm saying, though, is that she was one of the top talents for private instructors in the state of Texas. And she added on an extra hour of work a week after she heard me play. Because she was like, okay, yeah, I want to teach you. Her and I did not get along very well. I understood that she was the best teacher I was going to find. And she understood that I was the best student that she was going to find, at least within a couple age groups of that current time. And so we were kind of stuck together. But we did not care for each other very much, and we did not get along very well, very much. But she was an incredible, incredible instructor. Very knowledgeable. She was super incredible and married to her work. She was amazing. But so she told me before my senior year in high school, she said, hey, I have friends at this college and this college and this college. And she goes, look, I can already offer you 2 piano scholarships right now. But if you do what I tell you to do over your senior year in high school and learn what I tell you to learn it and do it the way I tell you to do it, you're going to get more. And I was like, all right, let's do this shit. And 3 months later, I was so pissed off with her, I walked away, and it's been over 20 years since. I was so pissed off with it. I hated it.
Now, recently, I know one thing we talked about when you came over was your rediscovery for the piano? I believe you were teaching a mutual friend of ours.
A buddy of ours' daughter. Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I have a piano in my living room, and I touch it maybe twice a month. It's embarrassing. Like I said, it's very hard to motivate yourself as an adult.
It's a nice piano. What kind of piano is
it? It's actually a very nice piano. It's a plug-in piano, an electric piano, but it costs as much as a quality upright. I bought it for, not only does it save space, but I also bought it for other reasons, which if you're curious about, I'll let you ask me and I'll get into it. Otherwise, it's just a boring conversation about pianos and $400 upgrades for wooden keys instead of plastic and bullshit like that. But I don't play very much, and it's something I want to fix soon. Otherwise, I'm renting it every month for $50 a month, and it's just a huge paperweight that's taking up space in my living room. I need to figure that out soon, or I need to shit or get off the pot, to quote a Kevin Smith movie, Clerks. But when it comes to a beginner, when it comes to a 5, almost 6-year-old young lady, yeah, I got taught by like some really great people. And yeah, I can totally pass on the knowledge if they're willing to put in the work. And this young lady is begging me for lessons. Begging me for lessons. I'm going over to our friend's place at least once a week. And every time over there, she's ready for the lesson. And so I'm really excited to pass on the knowledge. She's actually the reason why over the last few days, honestly, it's very that recent that I'm actually even considering maybe even trying to teach a little bit, even if it's just a side hustle, not a full thing. It's actually very fulfilling to see these young minds grasp on something and get it. But hopefully something will change soon. But as of this point in time, it would be unfair and inaccurate for me to say I've had some kind of revival with the piano. But teaching basics that I learned 30 years ago to a 5-year-old is nothing. What would be something would be for her or another student to be serious about it. And 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, I'm having to go back and restudy music theory and go over certain things. Music theory is like math. It sucks. But I would have to like go back and relearn things just to be a good instructor. So, but right now it's such in the beginning stages that, I mean, I haven't even got her Twinkle Twinkle Little Star yet. We're still working on how do you touch the notes with your fingers? How do you roll off of them with your wrist? And how do you do this and that?
The fundamentals,
yeah.
Which are very important.
Just like the technique for a free throw. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you got to have that. I mean, it's good for those very rare people that can just pick it up, right? But it's always good to have that basic.
That's something else I've struggled with the last couple of days too, not to cut you off there. But like, I never want to compare her to me. I picked up things very quickly. I happen to be very good. Not bragging. If anything, it's less than bragging because I'm talking about wasted talent. But as long as she's getting it and enjoying it, then the sharing of the music is more important than if she turns into, you know, the next Valentina Lisitsa or Yolun Sung, basically. That's more important than anything else, is the love of the music, the appreciation for classical music. That's what's more important to me.
No, you got to definitely have that love for the music, establish that appreciation.
Yeah.
Now, so we had the piano thing going, that the offer that you decided not to pursue. I know you eventually ended up in the military, the Navy in particular. What made you decide? Was it the fact that you had this military family that you made that decision? No, you're shaking your head.
I didn't want to interrupt you again. I'm talking too much. No. My father has pros and cons like every other father. If you're lucky enough to have a father around, a lot of people aren't. I need to count my lucky stars, don't I? But as far as military fathers go, I'd say I was pretty lucky. Because most military fathers, especially those that do 20 years plus, and it's their lives, a lot of them, I don't want to put a percentage, but a lot of them, probably over half, put undue standards and like military style standards on their kids, like raising them to be like, you know,
like little soldiers.
Yeah. I was about to say little Hitlers. And I was like, what else should I say besides that? You said little soldiers. I'm like, yeah, perfect. That's even better. That's perfect. My father had a unique routine, or at least it's unique as far as I know it to be. And I remember him describing it once. And he said that in his mind, he was never in the military unless he was in uniform. And my mother used to say that she could see him transition from one person to another as he got his uniform on in the morning to leave for work. And when he got back from work, he would take his uniform off and transition into dad or Michael or husband or whatever. He did a really good job with that. Of us three boys, of which, again, I'm in the middle, which explains how fucked up I am. He was never overly military with us, and none of us grew up wanting to join the military. I joined the military because, in a weird set of events, mostly set up by bad decisions of myself, I ended up homeless, living out of my truck in hotel rooms in Orange County, California, and my way out was joining the military. That was my way out.
So before we get to that, you were living, from what I understand, you said you had a van or you said a truck?
It was a truck. It was a little, I forget what year, I think it was a 97 Nissan XE. So it wasn't extended cab. It was a small bed, but it was a little pickup, a 5-speed pickup truck that I had. It was white. Yeah.
Nice. So you got a white pickup truck, Nissan, you said?
Nissan XE, yeah.
Is it where it's like it's got no back, it's just a two-seater one.
Two-seater, there's no seats in the back, and there's not extended cab either.
I had one.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. There's nothing. I mean,
a standard, but it could go, man. Like,
yeah, I had a standard. Okay. It was only 4-cylinder. It was nothing impressive, but yeah.
But it was reliable. I don't remember what exactly.
Oh, I loved the truck. But like, if you had anything more than like a picture frame to stick in the back, fuck you.
Yeah. So you're on the beach. How old were you at the time?
21
years old,
yeah.
On the beach in the
ocean. I wasn't on the beach. Or Orange County. I went to the beach on several occasions, but depending on where you're at in Orange County, you're a good hour away from the beach. Okay. I was the city boy in Orange County, California. I was not doing a Matthew McConaughey on the beach.
Okay.
It'd be cooler if I did, but that's not the case though.
That sucks. I wanted some like beach stories. Yeah.
Yeah, but I also drove around. God, what kind of can of worms are going to open up here? I also drove around female escorts and like had a bunch of different kinds of fun myself. I enjoyed California quite a bit, let me tell you.
Well, I mean, so I've never been to California.
Oh, wow. All right.
And you were there in early 90s?
Well, so I was there right before I joined the Navy, and I was there right after I got out of the Navy, which was 05.
Okay.
But both times were less than a year each. So I can't claim to, like, know California as well as anyone else that's lived there or anything like that. And both times I lived in California, we're in different spots. The first time was Bakersfield and then down to Orange County, where I joined the military out of. And we drove down to, San Diego to fly out to Chicago. And the second time I got checked out of a 2-week process in San Diego. And then a buddy of mine picked me up and we went up to Fresno. And I spent the next 6-7 months, wherever it was, 4 or 5 months up in Fresno before I got DUI. Had to move back in with my mom and dad in San Antonio with my tail between my legs and broke. And it was just an awful, awful time in my life. But yeah, so both times I spent in California were short stints. And I can't claim I'm like a Californian. I can't do that.
That's cool. That's fine. You're a citizen of the world.
You're right. It's not about one state, brother.
There you go. So we make the decision. All right, we're going to go into the military. Did you have a particular branch in mind, or
particular what mind
branch?
No. Well, yes. So even though I didn't have a particular interest in it, I knew I didn't have the money or the aptitude or discipline for college. So I actually did try to join the military twice beforehand. Both times were with the Air Force because my father was in the Air Force. Not that I'm not a tough enough G to be in the Army or the Marines or anything, but like, my father and his father were both retired Air Force. I wanted to carry on the tradition. Absolutely. If indeed I have to join the military. If there are two words that anyone in the Air Force can hear, and they will just tell you to fuck the fuck off with Ron Jeremy's crooked ass dick. And that is asthma and Ritalin. And I had one piece of paperwork by a doctor when I was 11 or 12, same time frame as the piano stuff, ironically, but with no connection. And saying that she suspected I had asthma. We went through a thousand tests. I even had an inhaler for a time. But apparently this woman was infatuated with asthma and diagnosed like 90% of her kids with asthma, when obviously that wasn't the case. I didn't have asthma. I never did. But because that word was in like 3 pages of medical records of my entire life, the Air Force wouldn't touch me. And to the point where I tried joining from a different city and my name still was red flagged up, to where I was blocked from joining the Air Force twice. So when I went to join in California, different state, different everything else, from Texas, from San Antonio, where I was trying to join before, I just instinctively was like, I'm going to stay away from the Air Force. Apparently, like, my name is in something. I don't know how the state-to-state shit works, but like, if I'm going to join the military and get off the streets, then I need to stay away from the Air Force. And the recruiting office I went to, a lot of times you'll have all four in a row, but the one I went to, there was an Army branch with the front door to it, a separate building, a separate office, but in the same building, and then right next to it, a Navy. And I went to the Army one first, because I'm like, Navy, pfft, bunch of pussies. You know, just like everyone else, like, pfft, bunch of pussies. You know, so I go in the Army one, and I remember sitting down with the Army instructor, and he was, or recruiter, excuse me, and he, I'm not talking shit about the Army, he seemed dumber than a pile of rocks. I couldn't get over how retarded he was. He made no sense. I can't give you exact examples, so please don't ask me. But I remember just sitting there having the impression of like, dude, you're a dumbass motherfucker, man. If the Army is made up of you, if you are the guy representing to recruit, then fuck the Army, bro. I have no interest in you at all. So now, again, though, I need to get off the streets, though. Right. So I'm desperate. So I don't just give up on the military. I go next door to the Navy. And I get this guy who ended up fucking me over pretty good. I don't know if the story will get into it, but it doesn't matter, though. I get this guy who tells me, I don't know how true it is, but it doesn't matter when you're a young man who just wants pussy. This guy tells me, he goes, Adam, I've been to 64 different countries, and I'm set to retire in the next like 6, 7, 8 months or something like that. He goes, I got laid in 63 of those countries, and only one time did I pay for it. And I'm like, really? And he goes, yeah. And he looks me dead in the eyes, and he goes, and Adam, if you'd have seen her, you would have paid too. I was hooked. I was like, maybe it is. Let's do this. And please remember, this was in late 2000. So this is before 9/11. We're in time of peace. I'm not thinking of let's go off and defend my country. I'm thinking, let's travel the world and get some pussy. So it wasn't like am I a tough guy or am I not tough guy type of thing. It wasn't an option for me. We'd been at peace for 10 years at that point after the Gulf War, which I remember vividly. My father was still active during the Gulf War. He wasn't over there, but it was a big family thing though. And so, I mean, it was a no brainer to me. I'm like, yeah, let's go off and chase some pussy. And I'll sail around for some pussy. I'll just pick it up like a plankton in a shark or whatever, you know, or a whale or whatever. And so it was a couple months before I actually started boot camp. It was February 5th, 2001 when I started boot camp. And I joined the fleet, I think it was July 13th or 16th of 2001 after boot camp and all that stuff. And it was a few months. I got to experience, let's say, a few months, like 3 months of peacetime military. And then 9/11 happened and everything changed. And then I saw the full mode of, oh, we were at peacetime yesterday. Now we're at war and everything is different now. Everything.
So
it was fucking nuts.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Apparel Up, the leading custom apparel provider in Houston, Texas. They help their customers represent their brand correctly with high quality, long-lasting custom apparel. Whether you're in need of embroidered scrubs for your medical practice, embroidered polos for your nationwide enterprise, or screen-printed shirts for your sport team, they got you covered. They also do the apparel for my show, so definitely buy some of that stuff too. And you can find their website at apparelup.us. Check them out. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Ranch Houston. Comprised of Ashe Yoga and Wellness, The Garden Project, and The Mill HTX, is an intentional, conscious organization created for adults to connect to an inclusive community through art, food, nature exploration, and movement, and for school-aged children to empower themselves through education on sustainability and edible gardening. Everyone is encouraged to connect to the curiosity of their inner child as they nurture their nature in a world that so often encourages separation and fear. Minority and veteran-owned, The Ranch Houston is located south of the Medical Center, and you can visit their website at www.theranchhouston.com. I highly recommend it. I've been there. It's awesome. Check it out. So how long were you in the military? When did you get into the military? What year?
I started boot camp February 5th, 2001. And I turned 22 in boot camp. I was a little older than a lot of people. So I turned 22 in March, and I was in boot camp when I turned 22.
So you got in before 9/11, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I was in the fleet. I was already in Japan. I was already stationed in Japan. I was already with my ship, the USS Juno, for a couple months, not very long, but like 2 or 3 months before 9/11 happened. Yeah.
Okay, so you get in, you're in the Navy, and you're basically on a ship in the water, right? That's a lot of your time. Or talk about what was it like being in the Navy? Like I don't know what the fuck that means. What does that mean?
It took me a while to figure this out, but the military is such a huge organization. Think of like, not a great example, but like the Catholic Church or like the YMCA or Boy Scouts. You're talking about an organization that's so huge that you have different facets that work a little bit differently from one place to another because they're so huge and they have to adapt to the regional aspects of things, right? Maybe Girl Scout cookies sell better in LA than they do in Fort Lauderdale. I don't fucking know. I'm making it up. But you're gonna, as a national organization or international organization, as the military is, you're going to make up for what you're doing. With the Navy, I'm trying to figure out how I want to word this correctly, with it, while not white line. So I was part of Amphibious Navy, which takes up less than 2% of the Navy. What is Amphibious Navy? Do you remember the opening scene to Saving Private Ryan?
Yes.
So you have all those guys, mostly Marines, but a ton of sailors, and they're on smaller boats that obviously didn't pass the ocean. These boats came out of bigger boats, and then they attack the beach out of these smaller boats, right?
Right.
That's Amphibious Navy, like an alligator, like a crocodile. It's an amphibious creature that can go from land from sea to land. I was part of the Amphibious Navy. That's less than, that's like 2% of the Navy. To give you another comparison, some Marines or some Mariners are, I believe, like less than 1% of the Navy. So what I experienced is not going to be necessarily representative of what someone else's average Navy life was. I've worked with other Navy vets in the past, and our stories are so completely different, it's ridiculous. It's not even comparable. You're talking about a worldwide organization that's different everywhere you're at. With that being said, though, I was in a foreign country in Japan, and I love Japan. I have nothing but good words to say about Japan. All my love and everything out to Fukushima and that disaster. They're still dealing with it. No one's talking about it to this day. We were what's called forward deployed. We were called tip of the sword. So anything that happens that side of the world, we're the first responders. So we were underway more. We were away from home port more than most people were in the Navy. And so I have a hard time answering that question because my experience is probably a bit different than a lot of people's experience. Not because I'm special by any means. It just is what it is.
What did you like so much about Japan? I have a little bit of a, so like a, I'm a huge fan.
May I take a break? No one was in this out. I really need to use the restroom. Is this a bad thing to do?
Is this gonna
fuck up the flow? No, I'm gonna hold on to this for like 15
minutes. Please take a piss.
I'm gonna take it.
Take it.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry about it.
I'm sorry. I don't know how that works, but I'm sorry.
I'm gonna make an announcement. So, for those of you that did not know this, I also have another podcast called The Weekly Wrap-Up. Now, The Weekly Wrap-Up has been on hiatus because of, for obvious reasons, the coronavirus decided that, hey, there's also no sports. So, we don't have any sports going on. Well, it's coming back. We got some soccer happening. We got definitely a lot of UFC going on. So, there's stuff that needs to be covered that I myself have not been covering. That will be coming back next week. Get all your sporting news, all your sporting opinions, and predictions. Just tune in for the weekly wrap-up on Spotify, iTunes, all that shit.
Sorry about that, dude. I hold on that for a minute, man.
Oh, man, you're good.
All right,
so where do we leave off? the Navy... Japan.
What did I love so much about Japan?
So before, I'm a huge Pride fan. I don't know if you know anything about Pride. Pride FC.
The fighting?
Yes.
Like Bellator?
So,
I'm not huge, but I'm definitely familiar. Yes.
So Pride, for those of you that don't know, is probably the greatest MMA organization ever to have existed. It's from Japan, and they do not give a fuck about steroids. So you just have like the best fighters, but they're in Japan on steroids, and guess what? They get paid more money. They got paid good money, and it was great. I loved it. And guess what? You could stomp people in the face, knee them in the head while they were down. You know, it was a little barbaric.
I don't agree with all those rules, by the way.
Flying head stomps. Like they would jump up in the air to do a head stomp.
Yeah,
it was
that's
brutal.
Awesome. Yeah, dude, that's awesome.
But either way, but the Japanese people are very like respectful and like courteous, kind. Talk a little bit about. So I know when you're in the Navy, you are allowed. They give you furloughs or will you go on land for a little while?
It's called Liberty.
Liberty.
Okay. It's called Liberty. Uh-huh. Yeah. I do not want to spend too much of this podcast talking about how much I love the Japanese people and culture, but I will tell you that I absolutely love the Japanese people and their culture. Few other places in the world can you leave your wallet full of cash in a taxi cab that drove you back to base and you're running back in time to make your midnight curfew, or you are fucked in the ass. And the next day you're like, oh shit, I left my wallet in the something. Or you have to at least have your ID, but whatever. You lose something in a taxi cab. And the next day, it's at the front post with all your cash in it. The honor and the awesomeness of the Japanese people cannot be overstated. They're caring, caring people. At the same time, though, I would say that it's like any other culture with mostly caring, awesome people. They're full of assholes, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would assume there's definitely a lot of assholes there. Like, hey, motherfuckers, y'all bombed the shit out of us.
Well, there is some of that for sure. But even not going there.
Right.
Which is a different destination to go if you really want to. But that's a couple of generations ago now, to be fair, though.
True.
But that's still a fair thing to say. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, they have the Nagasaki Nuclear Museum to this day standing there for people to go there to watch. Just go there and see. I never went there. The pussy was in Fukuoka. No, but also Japan has different laws than the United States as well. The United States, you cannot refuse service to somebody just because you want to. When they come in, if they're not dressed appropriately, if they act inappropriately, you can tell them to fuck off. No problem. But in Japan, it's straight up like you walk in the door and you're like a white dude like me, or just an obvious American like you. You're not white, you're Hispanic, but you know whatever, right?
Right.
Someone's obvious. You can tell how they're dressed. Obviously American, who walk in the door. They look at you, and I know this motion means nothing on a podcast, but they look at you and they go, Baka Gaijin, right to your face, the rudest fucking thing you'll ever see in your life. Baka Gaijin. And Baka Gaijin is basically like no aliens allowed. Now, you can take that interpretation as to mean no illegal aliens. But if you understand what the Japanese means, what they're really saying is you're a goddamn alien from another planet and you're not fucking welcome here. Fuck you.
Hold on. Where is this happening at?
Japan. Where I was stationed at. As a matter of fact, up in Fukuoka, where I told you all the pussy was, there's like only like two or three spots Americans can go. At least American military can go. I want to clarify that. And everyone else will be like, Baka Gaijin, go fuck yourself. You're not welcome here. Dude, we all have bigger dicks. We have American money in our pocket. The Japanese don't want to compete with us, bro. Even the Japanese that have decent sized dicks and a big sized pocket, a wallet, they don't want to compete with us, bro. It's straight up like, dude, fuck you, get the fuck out of here. And so they do have different rules. They're not, by no means are they a perfect culture or perfect whatever. But I will say, by and large, I had mostly nothing but positive interactions and memories of the Japanese people and the Japanese culture.
So how does the Navy work? First of all, how many years were you in the Navy?
4 years, 3 months.
And that time, were you stationed off of different spots of the world, or were you mostly in Asia? Where were you stationed?
So the way military contracts work is that, I can't speak too extensively on this, but I will speak to the overseas contracts. And that is that overseas contracts are DOD, which are Departments of Defense contracts. And those are 3 year long contracts. When you sign up for the military, most of us, the vast majority of us, sign up for 4 years. That's the standard. Even if you go back to the States on like a 2 year DOD contract, you cannot take that a contract without extending or re-enlisting your service to the military, because otherwise they will not send you somewhere else if you only have a year left on your contract, but it's a 2 year gig or a 3 year gig. So I went to Japan on a 3 year DOD contract, but you have to include on my 4 year contract, boot camp, A school, a month of leave, which is what most people do. I fall in that group with most people. I think it was like 20 something days, but whatever. It was close to a month. So you're already looking like 4 months in. So by the time my three year DOD contract is up, I only have like 7-8 months left on my contract. I can't go anywhere else. And that's where they get you a lot of times, because people that want to get out of their situation so bad will actually re-enlist or extend their contract just to get out of their current location because they want to get out of where they're at so bad. I've seen it happen time and time again. I didn't do that. But I did extend for a couple months. Like I said, I was in for 4 years and 3 months because I straight up, I don't know if anyone listening to this or you wants to think of me less than American for it, but I'll be absolutely honest. I extended for 3 months because I was straight up a fucking mercenary. I was participating in a war in the Gulf War, that I did not believe in. I did not agree in, but the money was fantastic, dude. It doesn't make me proud to say this, but it's the truth. I signed up for, I extended for 3 months to get that extra money in. I did not save up the money like I should have my entire time in the Navy. I knew I was getting out. And I knew it would be the toughest 3 months ever because I wanted to get out just as bad as everyone the fuck else wanted to get out. But I did it. So I saved up some money. Why? So I could blow it in Fresno on a DUI and move back to San Antonio with my parents with nothing. That's what I did all the extra work for, sir. So,
your country thanks you. Thank you very much.
Your country thanks you're welcome. Go fuck yourself, motherfucker. Whatever. So that's fair, though. That's very fair. I'll make fun of myself better than anyone else can every time.
So we make a full circle back to San Antonio. You know, we're talking about San Antonio earlier before we started, and we were talking about how I was telling you how people in Texas don't even know how big San Antonio is. I
didn't know the San Antonio was bigger than Dallas. So I mean, I fall in the same trap. So sure.
Yeah, because I was like, yeah, it's like top 10 in the country, and you were like, no. Well, you agreed on that.
But, no, I knew that.
Yeah, but
I did not. I did not remember that that San Antonio was bigger population wise than Dallas. That also depends on how you want to add in the suburbs and all that kind of stuff. But yeah.
So you come back to Dallas. How were you when you? I mean, Dallas, San Antonio. You come back to San Antonio. How old were you at that time? Did you like 25?
26.
26.
Yeah. 26.
So we're back, San Antonio, Texas. 26 years old. Money blown. So
thanks for throwing that in my face. I'm kidding.
So. What kind of job were you working at that time? Like what were you doing?
I'm sure. I was a bosun's mate in the Navy, which means nothing to anyone outside the Navy, but basically just think of manual labor and bullshit. And so it wasn't a job that really transferred to civilian life. So I went back to doing what I did before I joined the Navy, which is waiting tables. And I immediately went right back into waiting tables. And I've tried my hand at a couple other things in the meantime. But for the most part, I've basically just stuck at waiting tables for this entire time.
I'll tell you why I chose waiting tables. I've always felt that it was good money for what I was doing, right?
Yeah. It's full-time pay for part-time work, brother.
There you go.
It is. It is.
I've done construction. I've done all these other jobs, man. And it was just not, you know, when it comes to, I would work harder for the same amount. And then when it came to like, especially when you get to the level of fine dining, right? It's like, I've had people hand me $100 bills for doing bullshit. And it's just like, what? This is how this works? These people, when you're dealing with the 1%ers, right? When you're dealing with the people that don't give a fuck about money, it's pretty lucrative for really the amount of work. Like I'm holding hors d'oeuvres, making $400 or $500 sometimes a night. It doesn't make sense to me sometimes. You know, how is this happening? How am I making this money? You know, I came straight out of prison and was like, you know what I could do? Just like
in Victoria.
Well, I was actually I actually served before I ever went in, and I realized, you know, because I've always had this kind of hustler mentality, you know, where it's all about like how much is my hour worth. Like, I always, even from a young age, I always saw it like that, like an hour of my time. I would put a value on that. And
that's smart. My father, who was a retired financial advisor from USAA after his 21-year Air Force career, used to say the same thing. I'm sorry interrupting, but no, you nail it right in the head. He used to tell me this all the time. You have to put a value on every single minute of your life. And then after that, every time you spend a dollar, you have to compare it to how much you make per hour of your labor. I'm sorry to interrupt.
You're good. So that's one thing that I noticed when I was waiting tables. I was like, I would make all this cash in a short period amount of time. And I was like, for doing what? For doing what I would do for anyone that came over to my house that said, hey, you know what? I'd be like, hey, are you thirsty? Yeah, I could get for, yeah. So I bring, here's your soda. Oh, you know, I are you hungry? I got something, you know, I cook you up something. Yeah. I'm hungry for that. Like, that's not anything like, to me, you know, in the restaurant business, it's hospitality, right? But like in real life, it's just being a good person, you know, just being, having a guest come. You know, it's people, you know, we are a culture that is a, what was the proper term? Like, you know, we're tribal, right? We're meant to live together.
Every culture is tribal.
Right. So
I think that's a human nature thing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. We always have this, like, this welcoming approach to people coming over to your home, right? Like, hey, how you doing? At least that's what the way I was, you know, it depends how you're raised, right? But that's all.
But for most people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's one thing I always, and that's why, like yourself, you said you went back to it from the Navy. I went back to it as well. I did that before I went to prison, then I got out of prison, and boom, I went to
that. It's what you know.
It's what you know. And it's like we were saying, it's
there's a comfort level with what you know.
Right. What kind of things did you like about, because you, how long have you been in the service industry now?
Legally, in the age of Texas, you can't start working before the age of 16. And as far as I remember, like very shortly after I turned 16, I don't remember how shortly, but pretty shortly, I was a busboy at, I don't want to name places, but a country club in San Antonio. I got fired because I was an asshole. to be honest with you, I stole liquor out the back. That's a funny story. I'm not going to tell you the whole story because it's too time wasting. But basically, I didn't even know what liquor I should be stealing. And I stole bottles of like green Curacao and shit. Like, I didn't know what the fuck what I was grabbing. And I got fired for it because, of course, I would. And then I didn't go back to fine dining for years. I went over to busting tables at the Olive Garden and that was also my first waiting job. I got promoted from busboy to server I my very beginning was restaurants. It just is what it is. I don't know. Well, I don't know what else to say really because to be honest with you, I'd love to think I'm like a really deep, intelligent person, and maybe in some ways I am, and most ways I'm not. But to be honest with you, I'm just as average as every other person you'll ever meet in your entire life. And I will gravitate toward what's comfortable and what I'm good at. If you're not good at playing the piano, some people might keep playing the piano, but they're not going to pursue it. If you're not good at public speaking, you're not gonna turn into Winston Churchill. You're gonna gravitate what you're good at, and I wish I was good at like being a nuclear engineer or something. But you know what? I'm good at waiting tables. So whatever. I don't know what to say to that. But I think there's a common truth that I think most people would agree with on that. You're gonna gravitate toward what you know and you're comfortable with and you're good with.
One thing that I liked about waiting tables was I always viewed each table like a, almost like a new performance. You know, you kind of, you know, people, you especially you get to fine dining. It's a little bit different. It's people at that level appreciate the show, right? You see, right? I mean, some do, some don't, but the ones that
you gotta read the room, bro.
Right? You gotta read the room, but at the same time. If you sense it, it's not going to hurt you not to try to get that extra if you think you can get it, right? If you feel like, hey, maybe me or these people are nice, they're having a good time, because you can tell when these people want you to talk to them, they're very engaged for.
I agree and disagree with you. I mostly disagree with you because I don't think most people give a shit about you or me or their server as far as like when to get to know them or when to get to know us. But I would agree on the aspect of we live in Texas. We live in the South. Southern hospitality is actually a very real thing. It actually really is. People don't talk about it, but it actually really is a thing. And there are so many more people in the South that will take more interest in you than most other places from what I can tell. So you're actually right in a way, but I think you're right in my own personal way that you could totally disagree with, and that's fine. But I believe you're right in a way that's unique to being in a Southern state with Southern hospitality natures. But I think you're largely wrong if you're looking at a national or even much more a global way of waiting tables. I think you're wrong on that.
Okay.
But being from Texas, I can't fault you for thinking that way at all. I can't.
Yeah, because I mean, like you said, it's a culture, right? Texas is, like you said, it's a
Southern hospitality.
It's a thing. Yeah. Do you, any particular standout moments that you can think of where it was just like, wow, I can't believe that just happened?
With waiting tables?
Yeah.
Okay, I have one for you. It wasn't my first job out of the Navy, but my first job, or my second job technically, but my first job I quit after like a week and a half. Fuck that job. But my first real job back in San Antonio after getting out of the Navy. Remember I told you I was in Fresno. I failed and I moved back to San Antonio and I had a job that sucked for a minute or two. And I went over to, I won't name the restaurant, but I was at a restaurant. I will name the area, 2D1 and 1604 in San Antonio. There are a lot of restaurants around there, so no one can pin anything on this unless they know me and they want to comment on it. But, So I worked at a restaurant whose roof got on fire. Literally, you know the salamanders that are above the grill areas? We found out what happened afterwards. During the time, of course, we didn't understand what was happening. But afterwards, there are contractors that come in to clean out these vents to make sure, you know, they're clean. And, you know, shit doesn't happen, you know, obviously. Well, apparently these contractors didn't do the right job or whatever the fuck. And the salamander went up in flames. And it literally set the roof on fire of a restaurant that not only did I work in, but it was part of a building with like a Barnes and Nobles and like other businesses. It was a huge building. It was a strip mall area, right? At least five or six other Barnes and Nobles was a few doors down. They were never in danger, but whatever. It was a huge building though. We were on the edge of it. We were anyway. I remember us standing outside of the building. Actually, so to answer your question, so what was crazy about it is that it was during a lunch break, and most people that work like normal jobs, not like us waiting tables, but like normal jobs, right? They have like an hour, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less to grab lunch and they go back to work. That's all the time they've got. They're working with what they got. Well, they happened to go into a restaurant that day for lunch that got lit on motherfucking fire. Wow. So we literally had a restaurant filling up with smoke and it finally became like, dude, it was unedible. It was bad. It was bad. It was on fire, bro. All right. And then the line cook, whose name I won't say, but he's also deceased and a buddy of mine. But a line cook took out the fire extinguisher. And I mean, he didn't want to, because the moment you fire out this fire extinguisher, it's done. The restaurant's closed. Once you send out those chemicals, the restaurant's closed. It's done. That's health standards. You can't do anything about it. He was a he could have been a GM, but he was or a kitchen manager, but he wasn't. He was that influential of a guy. He busted out the fire extinguisher and was just like, and just took all the fire out and filled up the entire restaurant with. It was already filled up with smoke, but now it's filled up with
whatever the fuck shoots out.
Anti-firing bullshit. Yeah, exactly. Whatever the fuck that is. Thank you for saving me right there, Victor, because that could have been like 5 minutes of awkwardness. But yeah. And we're literally sitting there going, hey, everyone, you have to leave right now. You have to pay your tabs. You don't have to give us tips. Literally, we all understand what's going on, and literally everyone must leave right now. And you literally have people sitting there eating their food because they have no time. Before you judge them again, oh, they're so stupid. What the fuck are they doing? No. These are people that literally have no other time to go anywhere else to get food. They have to finish up their food and go back to work in a restaurant that's on fire. And it was crazy. And I remember there's a group of us outside after the fact. The fire was out. This is an hour or two later. We're staying outside the restaurant and we're all going, the roof, the roof is on fire. Hey, everybody, let the motherfucking burn. And then like after like 5 or 10 minutes of us jumping around singing this shit because we're dumbass young people, then all of a sudden we're all standing around going, do we have a job?
Yeah.
It took 10 days for them to fix the roof, and then everything got back to normal again. But if you're asking me for a weird experience, that's probably the weirdest experience I've ever gone through myself.
Any celebrities?
Okay. That's funny. Okay. So I have not taking care of like huge celebrities before anyone gets excited about the story. But I will tell you this. I was in San Antonio working at downtown Ruth's Chris. I will say something that only matters to people that live in San Antonio at the Sunset location. Anyone else, fuck it. It's not worth the explanation. But anyway, at the Sunset location, and there was a Saturday playoff game between the Spurs and the Oklahoma City Thunder. And that was back when
Harden was still over there.
Harden was still there. I remember. I don't forget the names. I don't remember. I'm not a big basketball guy, but Durant was still there. Russell Westbrook was still there. Okay. Now I waited on a table of 5 people. And by the way, I was newer server there. And it just so happened it was in the rotation that they got in my section. That's all it was. Okay. All it was. And Russell Westbrook was in the group, but there were two other players I didn't recognize and 2 other trainers that fucking nobody would recognize. Why would they? Unless you're some diehard fan, I guess. So I recognized Russell Westbrook and 4 of the people I didn't know. 2 of the players, 2 of the trainers, 5 top. And this was a Saturday where it was a playoff game, and it was like a, I don't remember, let's call it a noon game, a 1 o'clock in the afternoon, central time game, the San Antonio game, right? Texas game, the central game. And I don't remember who won the series. I think the Spurs won the series, but I don't think this game was representative of the series though. The Spurs beat the Thunder by like 22 or 25 points. It was embarrassing. It was hands down like we just destroyed the fuck out of the Thunder, okay? If I'm going to guess, this was in like 08 or 09, but I don't want to think about it too much. I'm probably wrong. But anyway.
I think that's the year that OKC beat them. Was it the Western Conference? 08, 09, I think, is when LeBron played OKC in the finals. But
I can't say. I just know there's a playoff game uh-huh. in like the first like 2 rounds of the playoffs. I don't remember if the Spurs won the championship that year or not. Dude, I'm not a huge basketball fan. I can just tell you though that the Spurs romped the fuck out of the Thunder that day. I don't even remember if they won the series, bro. But I remember they fucked the shit out of the Oklahoma City Thunder that day. All right? That's what I'm telling you. And so after the game, they choose to come into Ruth's Chris and they get my section. Out of complete habit, without me thinking of a single thing at all, me going, me literally going in front of a table of people I may or may not know, because I just know it's a Thunder table. That's all I know. Before I approach them, I don't know anything else. And I'm just going, I'm going to keep the script, fucking whatever it is. I'm going to stay comfortable. I don't want to fuck up. You know what I mean? So I literally walk up and I was like, hey, how's everyone doing this evening? And I have five people glare up at me like this. And you can't see it on a podcast, but it's a mean glare, bro. It's a mean glare. And I look at them and I go, and in my head, I'm like, whoops. And I look at them and I go, hey, guys, force of habit. Didn't mean anything by it. So would you like still or sparkling water? They're like, still water. I'm like, great. I'll be right back with that. And I felt so awful about it. Now, for the rest of the experience, I took care of them. I didn't talk about basketball or anything at all. At the very end, I told them something that was kind of true. And I said, hey, guys, I'm not even from San Antonio. I'm like, I'm not a San Antonian guy. Please don't take anything I said earlier in the wrong way. I didn't mean it like that at all. Have a great night. And they left me an average 20% tip, and I have no complaints to say about anything at all. I think one of the fucking managers or trainers paid or whatever. I don't fucking know. But if you're looking for a weird experience, that's one I could give you. There's another one or two I could, but that's the first one that came to mind.
I think I only served on one professional athlete, and that was Andy Pettit. And that was pretty cool because I'm a diehard Yankee fan.
I know you are. I know you are. You piss every Houstonian off with that bullshit of yours. I don't even like baseball, and I find you to be a contrarian ass, motherfucker. I'm kidding.
Well, I'm a little concerned because recently there was so apparently the Yankees were under investigation years back, and whatever they found was sealed. And now it's going to be unsealed. You know, I was very, very critical on the Houston Astros for the cheating.
Well, because you're a Yankees fan.
No. Because I am a fan of integrity.
Oh, sure.
Because
easy to say when you're a Yankees fan. Listen,
I believe you shouldn't cheat. Not like that. Like the blatant, like, okay, we have this camera and it's like zooming in and we're going to steal the signals and then we're going to transport the signals to the batter. Like, get the fuck out of here. Let's keep some integrity in the game. So if this information comes out about my New York Yankees, that my New York Yankees are doing that kind of level of bullshit, I will come on and I will let it be known how disappointed I am in my Yankees and how it is wrong and how it's fucked up. I'm not going to exclude them from this. I'm fair.
I'm not a baseball fan at all. So everything I say probably shouldn't be listened to at all. But as I understand this, I think what I'm about to say is fair, but you can tell me if I'm unfair. Minus technology-driven advances, basically, every team has tried to cheat for like over 100 years.
I agree.
Oh, so, fuck you, bro. Like, I'm not even defending the Astros. I don't even give a fuck about baseball. I don't even watch baseball. I don't give a fuck about baseball. But it seems pretty hypocritical if you're willing to allow every other form of cheating except the cheating that pissed you the fuck off.
Here's the thing. One of the great things about deception, right, is that if you are able to deceive and nobody finds out,
well,
then you need to be able to take credit for that.
That's a no cop, no stop fucking advance to that. No cop, no stop. Fuck that. I mean,
and I can't just sit here and be like, okay, well, everyone cheated, and just say everyone.
What about steroids, bro?
Okay, so I just saw the documentary. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I haven't. No.
It's okay.
Are you talking about Icarus?
No, Long Gone Summer.
Oh, I haven't seen either one, by the way. Okay.
Long Gone Summer, basically the documentary of the the Sosa McGuire home run derby that season.
I remember that year. I was actually busboying at Sun Center Country Club.
Year.
Country Club.
Ever.
All right.
In baseball. Ever. It's probably the only year you ever gave a shit about.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. It was.
Everybody gave a shit
about it. I didn't give a shit about baseball then or now, but that season I paid attention to the home run race. Yes. You're goddamn right I did.
Everybody did.
Oh, yeah.
Here's history. Everybody knows the home run, right? I mean, you're a sports fan, right? You're a big football guy.
Yeah.
It's like everybody knows how fucking hard it is to hit a baseball.
Dude, that's like hitting like the most touchdowns you could throw in a season, and it's even bigger than that. It's bigger than, I would argue, that's bigger than the Ironman record. I would argue that's a huge achievement. I really would. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So that was, I just saw that documentary and it was okay. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of it. I thought that they could have done a lot more with it. I thought it was kind of longer than it needed to be. Well, folks, thanks for listening. Adam, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Victor. I've enjoyed my time a whole lot.
We did an hour and a half.
Has it been that long?
Yeah.
It didn't feel like that long.
It never does.
Thank you very much. You've been such a great conversationalist, and thank you so much for asking great questions and being patient with me. And I thank you so much, Victor. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was easy. All right, folks. You have a good one.